It's the World This Week. The World This Week in partnership with the Daily Beast. Joining us from London, Nico Hines, world editor of said publication. How are you, Nico?
I'm very well. Good evening.
Good evening to Vivian Walt, Paris correspondent for Time Magazine. How are things?
Great.
Great.
Good to be here.
All right. We're going to put that to the test. John Henley, European affairs correspondent for The Guardian. Are you in the great category that Vivian's in?
Yeah, I mean, end of the week, but...
End of the week. Is it the end of the week in Athens? Let's ask France 24 correspondent Natalie Savarikas.
It always feels like the end of the week in Athens, to be honest, François.
Well, it's the beginning of the show, so stay tuned. The World This Week on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can subscribe, and you have been in ever greater numbers, to the audio podcast on Apple, Spotify, and other streaming platforms near you. It's the 1st of October. That means Britain's taking back control. As of this Friday, European travelers to post-Brexit Great Britain can no longer bring a simple identity card. Passports only, please.
By ending the use of insecure ID cards, we're strengthening our border and delivering on people's priority to take back control on our immigration system.
No insecure ID cards anymore, John Henley.
Yeah. I mean, that's a problem, obviously, for a lot of Europeans who are used to travelling around the continent using a straightforward ID card. Lots of people don't have passports. Lots of Europeans don't have passports. And they're going to need them. And it's going to be a particular problem for, student travel, school groups, that kind of thing. School travel organisers have already been complaining about the consequences for them. But, quite frankly, that's the least of Britain's problems at the moment, I think we can safely say.
Nico Hines, the least of Britain's problems?
Yeah, well, like anything else, I'm sure these new border controls will just mean massive queues at the border as people try and work out the new rules. And that seems to be the common theme of Brexit so far. We've just got massive queues everywhere and things not working as they used to. So we've got no petrol. People are queuing up the street to try and get it. We've got no food in the shops. So far, it just seems like there's a lot more complications to come with our huge new freedoms.
Yeah, hard to keep a stiff upper lip when you've been queuing for hours for petrol. In London, tempers running short this week as lines got long this Friday. Some one quarter of British service stations dry with scenes of shouting, fist fights, motorists hoarding fuel and water bottles. And it's, of course, Vivian Walt, not all about Brexit, these fuel shortages, this panic buying?
No, of course not. And Britain is not the only country, although perhaps it's the most stark example of a country that is having gas shortages. I mean, there are gas shortages in numerous parts across Europe and in China, most specifically. And you're seeing this kind of ripple effect through the supply chains. Shortages of goods, as people can't actually manufacture at the rate that they have been manufacturing. This is really one of those issues that has crept up almost without us noticing. There were price increases, of course, all through the year. I think it's taken a while for us to realize that this could be an actual major global crisis, and not to dismiss the fact that this does, in fact, have something to do with Brexit as well, because, as the British transportation minister said, Britain is now short of about 72,000 truckers, and those truckers actually transport the heat, the gas that. I think Britain now imports most of its gas to heat its homes. So it's really a very kind of dangerous situation, I think, as we enter winter.
Yeah, not all about Brexit, yet those truckers from the continent say they saw it all coming.
No one else has the kind of problems that we're finding here. It's because of Brexit. The borders, the checkpoints, the health and safety and extra checks, the loss of time at the borders and checkpoints, all kinds of issues related to the new paperwork, the extra paperwork that factories also have to carry out now. This will result in a monumental loss for the UK economy. I don't know how it's going to pan out for us drivers, but for the UK, it's going to be a huge economic problem.
A huge economic problem for you guys. Natalie Savarikas, your thoughts on this?
Well, it's interesting to watch Boris Johnson trying to navigate and scramble for solutions by issuing visas, you know, when at the same time Brexit was the very reason they were trying to kind of, you know, close the borders to foreigners, for example. And there was all this like rhetoric of being, you know, shouted left, right and center. It has been very interesting to watch it from Greece, especially as Greece is kind of coming out of a huge economic crisis and was kind of always looking up to Britain and other, you know, mega powers as the ones that would never, end up in such a mess. So it's really interesting to see how this will all pan out. And of course, all eyes are on the cold winter ahead with, Greece and Spain and other countries like that, wondering on how the price hikes when it comes to energy will affect households and the people throughout. And this energy crisis really rippling across the globe.
It's interesting, Nico Hines, because we're going to talk more about China in a moment, but it's this idea of the supply chains now have to be are so taut that to when there's the slightest wrinkle, it's got effects around the globe.
That's right, and you know, in Europe, we've got ourselves into this position where almost the entire continent is reliant on Russia's gas supply. And up until now, the Russians have been pretty careful about making sure that at least Northwest Europe, us, the big investors, get a good, clean supply of gas from them. And it's kind of never been interrupted over the years that we've relied upon them. But if you look at what they've done to countries that are in in competition or in conflict with them, so in Ukraine or in the Baltic states, suddenly, for either an explicit reason or for some secretive reason that we're not told about, suddenly the supply gets cut or cut back to those nations, and those nations are kind of feel a huge crippling impact. And we've given the Kremlin such a vast amount of power over our entire economies. If they wanted to cut off the gas supply to Europe, it would have a huge and devastating effect. Do you look at a problem with a few truckers are missing and we've got people, chaos in the streets? Imagine what would happen if the Russians actually made a concerted effort to harm us with this gas supply.
Yeah, last week, the Paris-based International Energy Agency asked Russia to open the tap on natural gas. John Henley, the implicit statement, which wasn't said openly, was that this was a way to pressure so that they'd open that Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that's to bypass Ukraine. When Nico talks about Russia being the one that's applying the pressure, how much of it is down to that?
Well, yeah, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, this was obviously a hugely controversial project, the whole Nord Stream thing, and obviously hugely controversial that Western Europe has basically, is now so dependent on supplies of natural gas from Russia, which, as we know, is certainly the current Kremlin regime is not exactly a friend of the European Union, and will use every sort of every lever at its disposal.
And we had this Friday the Hungarians welcoming the arrival of Russian gas via a southern route.
I mean, the politics of energy are clearly going to be a huge huge debate and potentially a massive problem over the coming decades, without a shadow of doubt.
And it's not just Europe, as Vivian Walt was saying, facing an energy crisis at the outset of winter. China's top state-owned energy companies have been ordered this Friday to keep fuel supplies running at all costs, skyrocketing post-pandemic orders at factories, coupled with a drop in coal supplies, have sparked rolling blackouts in many places in China, like in Shenyang, that's northeast of Beijing. Right, so that restaurant owner trying his best to keep the lights on in his establishment there, Vivian. It's impacting China, but you could say this is the whole world's problem, since they're making the stuff that we buy.
Exactly. I mean, China is overwhelmingly the world's factory. It's where, you know, everything that we buy and use daily comes from. And certainly, you know, it's hard to find a single ingredient item in your closet or your kitchen that doesn't have something in it from China. The idea that Chinese factories would not be able to cope with that kind of global demand is very unsettling. It potentially has a massive ripple effect globally. And we're just starting to see the effects of that. We're starting to see shortages, certainly perhaps not quite so much here in Europe or in France, but certainly in the US. There are items that are way back ordered. There are, you know, simply supplies that just haven't been able to be fulfilled.
Natalie Savarikas, we saw last year with COVID that a lot of people here in Europe, and the French finance minister was going on about it a lot, the fact that we're waking up to the fact that so much of what we depend on is made in China. I know where you are in Greece. It's a country that before the pandemic enjoyed increasingly close ties with Beijing. Has the conversation changed now?
Well, in Greece, especially with the arrival of the Greek Prime Minister, Conservative government, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, there's kind of an entire shift, you feel. What we're talking is a person, like they're investing, for example, in a lot of renewable energy sources, like all of a sudden Greece is aligned with European targets. Also, what he's interestingly very doing, and we're probably going to discuss this later, is how he's focusing on regional alliances. Alliances and kind of like focusing on the energy that will come out of the reservoirs of the Eastern Mediterranean and trying to build pipelines there with other regional players, etc. So it's a kind of an effort by Greece to kind of rid itself of its reliance on what the rest of the world is doing and trying to kind of like do its own thing and looking at trying to kind of become a regional player as well, whether it's in energy or in other sectors as well.
Yeah, trying to shorten supply chains is again what we're talking about.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so extraordinary. I mean, just to come back to where we started to come full circle, if you like, that you know that Britain should have decided to throw up these. I mean, Britain, as somebody said during the week, and this was really the phrase that struck me during the week. You know, Britain is in the middle. Brexit is basically Britain has essentially declared a trade war on itself in the middle of a pandemic.
The Times of London has quoted the British Meat Press Processors Association as saying the sector is short 15,000 workers and up to 1,000 butchers could now be allowed.
I mean, the major, major panic is going to be whether there'll be enough turkeys for Christmas in Britain at the moment. You know, if there aren't enough turkeys for Christmas, then that really will be serious trouble. But I mean, joking aside, it's quite extraordinary. Because the British government did have the option to extend those, albeit, you know, they seemed interminable at the time, the Brexit negotiations. In the middle of the pandemic, there was the opportunity to sort of push back the final Brexit date, so that all these controls and changes and these big barriers that basically Britain has thrown up between itself and its largest trading partner, you know, there might be a bit of a respite and a bit of delay, and Boris Johnson's government said no, we want to do it as soon as we can.
But so far he seems deft at changing the conversation when he needs to, goading the French last week, a bit more fishing row.
Well, you have to ask,
rhetoric this week.
You have to ask how long that can really last. I mean, at some stage, reality is going to catch up, I think. And, you know, we've started to see it this week with the petrol shortages. We've started to see it with shortages of foodstuffs. And, you know, once British people really start to feel the consequences personally, then, you know, how much longer will he be able to say that none of this has got anything to do with Brexit? I mean, what's interesting is that up until now, they have more or less been able to hide the negative consequences of Brexit behind the pandemic and say, you know, a lot of this is due to it. And there is a lot of the causes were to do with the pandemic. But what's, I think, without absolutely, you have to say with complete certainty is that Brexit is making it almost impossible for the British government to respond to the crisis. It might not be entirely responsible for this crisis, but it's making it very, very hard for much harder for the government to respond to it.
Again, Nico Hines, I want to play devil's advocate here. It's not the Labour Party conference this week that's turning the tide in any way when it comes to British politics, even in the face of these gas shortages.
Yeah, you know, it does take a while for these things to filter through and for people to make connections. But I think ultimately, if you look at the polling that came out over the last week about this petrol crisis, even people who voted for Brexit say that Brexit's to blame for the petrol crisis. Not a huge proportion of them, but people are starting to realise. And I think the latest poll had something like 51% of people saying that Brexit had probably been a bad idea on reflection. And so these things will continue to trickle through. I think, though, what everybody said, and, you know, to defend the Brexit crew, they did say there would be bumps, you know, we'd have problems at the beginning. And I think, basically, as a nation, we expected that, and we're willing to forgive the government that. Some people giving them no rope to forgive themselves at all. But most people are willing to forgive them a little bit. But the real test will be, can they get hold of this? And at the moment, Boris seems to be in hiding. There's no sign of him getting a grip on this crisis whatsoever. But I think people are waiting now. And
yeah, just I was going to say briefly before we go to the break, you heard John Hendley worrying about Christmas turkeys. I'm looking ahead to next week. You have the president of the National Farmers Union saying 150,000 pigs could be culled.
Yeah, and these things will be, you know, the government will try and keep them away from the cameras, I'm sure, but these things will start to become into our consciousness and people will begin to realise this is the consequence of Brexit. And Boris has got a very small window to try and turn it around and salvage himself, or come next year, he's going to be in big trouble.
All right, a prediction there from Nico Hines. Before we go to the break, stay with us. Much more to come in the world this week. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's The World This Week, The World This Week in partnership with The Daily Beast. The Daily Beast world editor, Nico Hines, is with us from London. Vivian Walt, Paris correspondent for Time Magazine, is with us. John Hendley, European Affairs correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. And from Athens, France 24 correspondent, Natalie Savarikas. If you're wondering if the French are still mad at Australia over that surprise cancellation of a multi-billion euro submarine contract and the shutting out of Paris from a US-led Indo-Pacific military alliance, well, now comes news of the postponement of a long-planned round of Australia-EU free trade talks. Now, a measure of consolation did come on Tuesday, with France announcing the sale of three frigates to Greece, Emmanuel Macron selling the deal as a step on the road to Europe's strategic autonomy.
Europeans must stop being naive. When we are under pressure from powers who at times harden their stance, we need to react and show that we have the power and capacity to defend ourselves, not escalate things, but simply to be respected.
All that's missing, Vivian Walt, is the European anthem there, but is this, in fact, well, just an arms deal?
It is an arms deal, and it's a very tiny one compared to what was planned with the Australians. It's $3 billion as opposed to, you know, nearly 60 billion, 3 billion euros, pardon me, as opposed to nearly 60 billion euros. I think what's really a little bit disturbing is that this isn't about Europe. It's about France and Greece. And you don't really have the EU behind this. And in fact, there's a real deep divide within the EU. So it's really about confronting Turkey. And in that respect, you don't have the Germans on board. And so you really have what seems to be, especially after the whole debacle around AUKUS, the US and Australia, you seem to have this sort of sense of fracturing. Instead of NATO coming together, Europe coming together, there are all these private little alliances going on.
And when it comes to Turkey, the French have gone all in on the side of Greece, it seems.
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? And I agree completely with Vivian. We're heading towards kind of like constellations of mini alliances, and it's going to cause problems within the EU, and it's certainly going to cause problems within NATO. On the other hand, you could see this as Emmanuel Macron wanting to push Europe. Ever since his big speech after he was first elected at the Sorbonne in 2017, when he first mentioned this idea of, you know, Europe's sort of strategic autonomy has to be greater. In a way, you could see this as him essentially saying, you know, as somebody said this week, you know, defense strategy is not a spectator sport. you actually have to get involved and get in there and push towards what you're working towards.
All right, and whether it's about territorial water disputes or stopping migrants from reaching Lesbos, the Greek prime minister, for his part, standing by the deal.
I am unapologetic about defending our borders. We should not forget that back in 2020, in March 2020, Turkey instrumentalized the migration issue and actively encouraged and facilitated tens of thousands of people to try to cross into Greece. We said no, we defended our land border. We are defending our sea border, but we're doing it with full respect to human rights, putting the protection of people at sea always as a first priority.
Natalie Savarikas, care to fact check what we just heard?
Actually, it's very interesting because when you see it from this side of Europe, which is basically the eastern flank of the continent, things are slightly different. First of all, I mean, yes, it is like three frigates worth around 2.9 billion euros, but it's also an additional. There's like a little asterisk to all of this agreement. There's kind of another 3-4 billion when it comes to the 24 Rafale jets, an upgraded agreement between Greece and France. There's also modernizing Hydra-class frigates. There's also corvettes involved. There's a lot more that's coming. And for the ordinary Greeks that I was speaking to today, you know, to get their views on this deal, they're like, seriously, you know, we're going to give around 6-7 billion euros to France when we have such other alarming priorities in the country to deal with. And again, you know, when you see it from this side of Europe, which was the gateway for millions of migrants in 2015, the peak of the migratory crisis, Greece had to shoulder all of this. Again, when Turkey got pretty bellicose last summer and the two frigates collided, France was the only one who stood up to Greece. You know, the rest of the Europe was pretty much twiddling their thumbs. And Greece is tiny. You know, their army is pretty tiny. Their fleet is tiny. It's very old as well. They can't stand up to Turkey, who's like kind of like the third top fastest growing arms exporter in the world, or which has like the second or third biggest NATO military personnel. So all of this, you know, again, from this side of Europe, it seems kind of different.
Yeah, but again, as you point out, Natalie, the French aren't giving them three frigates and Rafale fighter jets. They're selling them. And it's at what point does it become a conversation topic?
Well, as far as the Greeks are concerned, there, alongside this arms deal, there was this defense-like partnership, which comes again. NATO has it, Article 5, you know, collective defense. When one member is attacked, everyone comes to help. But, you know, when Turkey is also in the NATO alliance, and Turkey is kind of, we've seen, operating quite differently. It's cozying up to Russia to get arms, you know. It's Erdogan has a kind of different approach to everything, and he is quite erratic in his behavior. Now, Greece considers him a big threat to its borders. We also saw how they came out with an announcement today saying that, you know, this alliance between France and Greece is actually going to harm the EU as well. A lot of strong words coming from the Turkish leadership, making Greece feel quite uneasy. And again, it is the, you know, border of the European Union. And again, France last year, other than the arms deal, again, France was the only one who kind of came to Greece's rescue. And now with this partnership, should Greece again need the help of anyone, France will be there. And I think that's what was felt in Greece, at least, again, because from what I'm hearing from you all, you disagree, that this is kind of Macron's effort to kind of go towards a more autonomous Europe that is not reliant on the US, that can kind of be more, you know, independent.
Something we'll be talking about more in the days and weeks to come. In other, look, turning our attention to the African continent, we saw this week the best and worst of the United Nations. 7 UN staff expelled from Ethiopia after the world body stood up to Addis Ababa, calling out the de facto blockade of war-torn Tigray, which puts civilians in that rebel province at the risk of starvation.
In Ethiopia, the UN is delivering life-saving aid, including food, medicine, water, and sanitation supplies to people in desperate need. We are now engaging with the government of Ethiopia in the expectation that the concerned UN staff will be allowed to continue their important work.
And Nico Hein, since that statement, the UN Secretary General has spoken with the Ethiopian Prime Minister, and the UN standing by what it says when it comes to the use of food aid as a weapon of war.
Yeah, and I think this is a very worrying development, the way this is all going down, because, you know, you've got to remember that the Ethiopian Prime Minister was a Nobel Prize winner just a couple of years ago, supposed to be bringing peace to the region. He's now seemingly willing to have an outright kind of war of words, if nothing stronger as yet, with the UN, having UN people ordered to leave the country. And you just think, if he's not willing to back down in the international glare of the media because he doesn't care what people say, what else is he willing to do? I think it's a very, very worrying time.
So that was perhaps the UN showing its strong side. On the weaker side, there was that investigative report last year that exposed sex abuse among contractors and staff at the World Health Organization. An internal probe now at the UN has confirmed that more than 80 workers, including 23 WHO staff, were indeed suspected of sexual abuse. This was while they were fighting the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The review team was able to establish that the alleged victims were promised jobs in exchange for the relationships or were sexually exploited in order to get and keep a job.
Vivian Walt, this is not the first such scandal.
Exactly. It's not the first such scandal, and it has affected numerous countries that the UN has been involved in. We've had years of allegations about UN peacekeepers, for example, and widespread sex abuse among UN peacekeepers in Haiti, Somalia, Central African Republic. This is a fairly, you know, repeated story. And just to take the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, You know, ironically, the UN has fought a campaign for years about rape in the DRC as a weapon of war and accusing armed groups, quite rightfully so, of using rape on a widespread basis in war-torn parts of the country. And, you know, to turn around and find out that one of your own agencies has been using effectively the same methods in a desperately poor country. What's so disturbing about the story is that you have the kind of disjuncture of a rich organization, relatively rich organization like the WHO and the UN, going into what is desperately poor areas where people...
Is there always going to be an abuse of power amongst human nature as such that if you have people who come to an area, like you say, that's desperate, where people are desperately poor, there's always going to be abuses?
Well, hopefully not always, but I mean, it is so common. And, you know, going back to biblical times, of course, you have in war-torn situations, or in simply natural disaster situations or pandemic situations, you have the possibility of people who are simply desperate enough to sell themselves for food or job or any kind of small favor.
And there happens to be an Ethiopian angle to this story. The WHO chief, Tedros Adhanom, he is a Tigrayan himself. He's up for re-election next month. He's not gotten the support of his home country, but that is because of domestic issues, which we just talked about. He also has visited Congo 14 times during the Ebola outbreak. Tedros saying no one had raised the allegations to him, and he said it was heartbroken by what's been uncovered.
I'm sorry for what was done to you by people who were employed by WHO to serve and protect you. I'm sorry for the ongoing suffering that these events must cause. I'm sorry that you have had to relieve them in talking to the Commission about your experiences.
When you look at the story, John Henley, do you see it as just the scandal, or are they doing what it takes to make amends within the WHO?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, the fact that, as Vivian said, you know, this does seem to be a repeating problem, and so you'd have to say that, you know, that clearly there is a problem with the WHOs and the UNs, and we've had these both with UNICEF. Well, you know, there's clearly systemic issues there, but I think what's essential now, obviously, you know, is that justice has to be done and has to be seen to be done. That there has to be compensation paid to these victims, because it's a dreadful. Above all, it's just an appalling abuse of power and of status. You know, these are immensely vulnerable people who are being abused, and it's clearly it's a systemic problem, and it's going to be. It really needs to be sorted out.
And you heard Nico Hines talk about whether the fact that the current Prime Minister of Ethiopia is a Nobel Peace Prize winner there. Some that saying Tedros should be a Nobel Peace Prize winner before this happened.
I mean, it's not going to help his cause.
It was, before we go, a week where you could borrow the line by William Shakespeare, "Lord, what fools these mortals be," as we grapple over blue passports or flex muscle in the South China Sea, the Cumbre Vieja reminding us that humanity power plays don't amount to a hill of beans when Mother Nature decides to rumble into action and show its true force. In the Canary Islands, the locals remember the last eruption of this volcano exactly 50 years ago.
I lived through the Teneguía eruption, but it has nothing to do with this one. This one is a tragedy.
Natalie Savarikas, what's... have you been inspired by, but when you see these incredible images of the lava, which is now flowing out of a third crack inside of that volcano?
absolute terror. And I'm especially, I mean, how nature is in complete control of pretty much everything once it decides to do so. And how, I mean, the actual island is also expanding, you know, with the molten rocks solidifying and when they touch the water and creating a kind of peninsula there. I mean, it was horror, but at the same time, this was one that you can't really control. But at the same time, without wanting to divulge, you kind of think of what humans are in control of, and that's climate change. And we kind of saw similar scenes of horror in southern Europe with the fires, which were mainly attributed to climate change and everything.
Vivian Waltz, right now, the French presidential election, we're not talking much about it. Yeah, the Greens had their primaries this week. But, I mean, it's not been that much of an issue like it was in Germany. When you see the force of Mother Nature, is that going to wake people up a little?
I doubt it. I mean, look, we're still 6 months away from the presidential election. But I think this presidential election... climate
might. It will be on human issues.
It will be on human issues. It will be on COVID and the economy.
Nico Hines, when COVID hit, we said, here's this event that's not men, that isn't like, it's not like a war or some kind of fight. It's a virus. And we thought, oh, this is going to give us a sense of perspective. Now that the vaccination rates are up, we seem to be back to our old squabbles. When you look at that volcano, what does it tell you?
I think it does remind us of how puny we are. I mean, it's funny because, you know, the Canary Islands, this kind of wonderful place, a kind of idyll that people hop to for a bit of winter sunshine. And it's known as being a volcanic archipelago. But of course, no one actually thinks, what does that mean? And it is incredible to see the creation of new land right before our eyes. It's quite inspiring. But I think, unfortunately, if anything, it probably is more likely to lead into the old argument of we're just such little people. What is it? What can we do as individuals to change these great things ourselves anyway?
All right. What can we do? It's certainly something that we'll keep on talking about. Nico Hines, I want to thank you so much for joining us from London. I want to thank Vivian Walt, John Henley, Natalie Savarakis in Athens. Thank you for being with us here in The World This Week.